Welcome to the parliamentary podcast series, Partnering for Global Impact, presented by the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The podcast is brought to you in partnership with the parliamentary engagement teams of the World Bank and IMF. Join us as we engage in discussions with leading development experts and parliamentarians from around the world. Together, we'll explore how we can take decisive action to achieve a world free of poverty on a livable planet. Now, please welcome your host, Liam Byrne, Chairman of the Parliamentary Network.
Well, Lord Fafnir, it's a huge honour to welcome you here to the House of Commons on what's actually quite a rainy Tuesday. I think you've been over here for some of the big meetings of the Commonwealth today, but hugely grateful to you spending a little bit of time with us to chat about climate change and what the World Bank and the IMF need to do to help.
Yeah, it's definitely an honour to be here, also to attend the Commonwealth Service, Westminster Abbey. And I'm sorry for bringing the bad rain with me. I heard you had good weather last week.
Oh, no, it was lovely. Yeah, no, we always have this final blast of bad weather before Easter. So I'm sorry it's coincided with your visit.
Yeah, but it's typical. I mean, I expect nothing else.
Well, look, we really wanted to pick your brains about climate change and how climate change was really impacting on small islands in particular. Mm-hmm. And it would be great just to get a sense from you about how Tonga is being hit by climate change now and how the people that you came into public life are having to cope.
Tonga is a small island developing state, and like other low-lying states, we're highly vulnerable to the rise in sea level. And similarly, because of climate change, we're now seeing other effects on the climate, such as more intense, more frequent tropical cyclones, and also different varying extremes of weather. So for that impact our agriculture, when it rains too much, and when it doesn't, we end up with droughts. So that has a real impact on our subsistence farmers, on food security. And on low-lying islands, has an impact on water security. So very close to home for islanders and people in small island developing states.
And how do people cope with that? How do families and businesses adapt to those kind of pressures?
Speaking about adaptation and addressing climate change, it's twofold. There's mitigation, which is about lowering the carbons that we release into the atmosphere. So transitioning from burning fossil fuels into using renewable energy so that we have less of an impact on the atmosphere and climate change, greenhouse gases. Mitigation for us as a country that's producing negligible amounts to the global output on carbon. The issue for us is that adaptation is harder to finance because it's all about infrastructure. It's about hardening your resiliency, and that tends to be less financial than mitigation because, you know, you can always do a PPA or get independent power producers to install solar and wind and power from battery energy storage systems. Mm. That tends to be more financial than what we need, which is adaptation. Mm. And that means research into more resilient crops. It means seawalls to stop the rise in sea level, destroying key infrastructures and people's businesses and homes.
And how does it show up politically for you? So I remember traveling a lot in Africa last year and huge pressures from drought, huge pressure for new water systems and irrigation systems in particular. But families were just under the most incredible pressure. And often in some parts of the world, you saw fathers having to go further and further. If they were herders, for example, I heard some villagers talk about the way in which girls were being sent out to get married earlier. Boys' education was under pressure. Generally speaking, boys and girls were not in education in the same way. So you could really, for a lot of our parliamentarians, they represent constituencies where families were just under the most extraordinary kind of pressure because of climate change. And that was having a political impact too. So I just wonder, in Tonga, how does this appear in the political debate?
I know in some of the developed states, there's still the question of, does climate change exist? Mm. And in places at the forefront of climate change, we're experiencing it day to day. And the question is a no-brainer. It's a bipartisan issue. It's one that the whole country is on board. Mm. We understand that there is change. And in terms of how that would impact people's livelihoods, we're seeing take the cost of energy, for example.
Yeah.
The drive to decarbonize our energy system is not just so that we're being more responsible for the planet. It's also to insulate ourselves from the external shocks that impact the cost of living. So, for example, we saw upwards of 13-16% inflation at one point. And it was because we had the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And the restrictions on oil supply from OPEC all at the same time. Yeah. So these are massively foreign concepts that are happening halfway around the world that is having a real impact on the cost of living in the islands to the tune of double-digit inflation. And that does have an impact on people's livelihoods. It means that we have to be more careful about the amount of power that we use because we're predominantly burning diesel for our power.
Mm.
The extremely high tariff rate means that people have to switch their air cons off. They have to be wary about when they leave the kettle on and how much power they consume on a day-to-day basis. Just be more responsible with how much light you turn on at night and whether you keep it on all night for security or turn it off because you can't afford the power bill.
And it sounds like you can see the relationship between climate change and an impact on poverty fairly clearly.
Absolutely. Yes. And what climate change does is that it exacerbates the issues that low-income countries already have.
Mm.
Tonga, according to an ANZ report released September last year, I believe, has a $1.5 billion infrastructure deficit. That infrastructure deficit means that in order for us to be more resilient in the face of climate change, when a massive or external event like a tsunami or a tropical cyclone or earthquake or whatever happens, hits the islands, we're already set back by the last disaster. So in the middle of our road to recovery, we'll already be set back by the next external event.
So it feels like you're going backwards.
It feels like we're constantly going backwards. Yeah. And that's because of that lack of resiliency from the under-hardened infrastructure that we have.
Yeah. How clear are the solutions? So you said there's a cross-party consensus in Tonga about some of the things that need to happen next. Is it clear what the adaptation plan needs to look like?
Look, we, like most countries, we have a wish list.
Uh-huh.
And it is clear we have great ambition to achieve our decarbonization. In 2010, Tonga was one of the first countries to release what we call TERM, Tonga Energy Roadmap. And that was to achieve 50% of our energy needs by renewable energy. Mm. And that was a 10-year plan from 2010 to 2020. So the ambition has always been there for a while now. But come 2020, our renewable energy penetration was only at 13%.
Gosh.
Today, I think it's at 18. So the government has, despite the challenges, released a new TERM Plus, Tonga Energy Roadmap Plus, which takes us up to 70% by next year. So the ambition is there for us to decarbonize and to be responsible for the climate and the environment in the world. But the lack of capacity, access to finance, and the capability to achieve it is another big challenge.
So when it comes to partners like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, have they proved important in helping access to finance already?
Like I said, we've had the national plans. We've had the national ambition to achieve some of this adaptation and mitigation. But for some reason, it sort of hasn't been supported enough by the multilaterals.
Mm.
And given that there were direct access funds, such as the Green Climate Fund, that were set up to bridge that kind of gap between the traditional multilaterals and the needs of countries that need to adapt, it hasn't been very successful.
Yeah.
As you're aware, the Green Climate Fund is filled by pledges from the North, and those pledges didn't reach what was promised. And as a result, the fund hasn't performed as well as it should have.
So you're in a position where the good citizens of Tonga didn't cause climate change, but you can now see an impact on poverty because of climate change. But richer nations are not stepping up to the kinds of pledges that are needed to plug the financing gap.
In a nutshell, yes.
Yeah. And there are programs like support programs for small islands. Have they been of any value so far?
Yes, they have been of value. But like I said, the ambition is high, but we haven't been able to meet that with the resources available.
And do you have a sense of what the scale of new financing is that might be needed? Presumably it is in the billions for some of the transitions that you're talking about.
Yes, and we did attend COP27 and COP28. We have massive delegations that go, and in terms of the scale of finance that's available, there's always talk of finance. There's always funds that are available, private investment, and also grant access and all of that. But we've never quite been able to see that come through, filtered down to those in need, such as the small and developing states.
But how does that make people feel in Tonga? You go, I mean, you make the investment in going to these international delegations. They're all very high profile. There's lots of big talk about the agreements that are brokered. But then when reality bites, when you get back home, it doesn't seem you're getting the kind of support that you need.
And if anything, the leaders are to blame.
Yeah.
We attend the meetings, we come back, and then we non-perform. But that's because we come back with promises that are broken.
And how does, I mean, that? But it sounds like you've been through that cycle a couple of times now. I mean, does that mean that frustration levels are now growing, weariness is growing, cynicism is maybe growing?
All of the above. Weariness, you know, and people get complacent because climate change is a slow change. It's not sudden. We get to live with the new norm. And over time, you start to think back, 10 years ago, it was slightly different to where it is now. And then you wonder, what haven't we been doing? Where were the plans that we needed to implement? As case in point, Tonga Energy Roadmap from 2010, come 2020, we never got anywhere near the ambition, which was 50%.
Yeah. So this is a big year for the World Bank and the IMF. You've got some IMF programs which have now been underway for almost a year. So things like the Resilience and Sustainability Trust, Poverty Reduction and Growth Trust have been up and running for a little while now. But the World Bank is going out to replenish one of its biggest funds, IDA, in the IDA 21 round. What are the kinds of messages that you want politicians in richer countries to hear when the World Bank and the IMF come to sort of say, look, it's time to step up to some of your responsibilities and contribute more?
I think it's just that as a planet, we're all responsible. And I think I recall what the politicians from Pakistan were saying when there was unprecedented flooding there that completely destroyed their food stocks and a lot of livelihoods. I think Antony Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, said that this was completely humanitarian disaster, one at a level and scale that the United Nations hasn't seen before. What they're saying is that what happened in Pakistan won't stay in Pakistan. And on that note, what's happening in the Pacific and in other small and developing states won't stay in the Pacific. At some point, everyone around the world will feel the squeeze of climate change.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's unfortunate that we have this sort of syndrome like, you know, is it the frog that's inside the...
Yeah.
The inside slowly, the
yeah.
yeah. And, you know, he's just like, oh, it's getting a bit warmer. And then we learn to live with it until it's too late.
Yeah.
And that's really the cautionary tale here is we don't want to be that. This is only an indication of what's coming for the rest of the world. And being at the forefront, we would like to think that, you know, we don't want to be a lesson that people would ignore until it's too late.
So some of the academic work and some of the policy work around the Bridgetown Agenda, for example, has estimated that the amount of multilateral lending that we need needs to triple. I mean, this is a big order of magnitude, and we're not going to rely on that money alone. That's got to lever in private sector investment too. Do you feel that the private sector investment is potentially there if we can get the multilateral investment in as a foundation?
I don't want to be too controversial, but to quote one of the IMF's reports, the amount of money that global taxation is subsidizing fossil fuels worldwide, I think it was $7.2 trillion.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's huge. And that's implicit and explicit subsidies. That's existing taxation.
Yeah.
Now, to draw comparisons to the Sustainable Development Goals, in order for us to achieve the SDGs, we're now at the midpoint now. We're way off track. In order to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, we have to double global taxation. Now, either we're going to double global taxation to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, or double global taxation in order to adapt and mitigate to climate change. Why don't we just reallocate the existing taxation that we are subsidizing fuel, fossil fuels, into adaptation and mitigation, and then fund some of those channels that need to go where it's prioritized, such as the small and developing states?
Yeah.
To me, that means that we're using public funding and not accessing private, because when we start to incentivize private, there might be some unforeseen externalities and maybe the motivations behind what we need can be skewed.
So in a way, that could be something that in the parliamentary network, we try and show more of a light on actually the level of subsidies for fossil fuels that are currently...
It's existing public funding.
Yeah.
That we can, instead of the taxpayers funding the degradation of the climate, maybe they could be doing the opposite. And right now, I don't think much light is being shown on that.
Yeah. Alongside money, what else is important? We've had some debate in, for example, the World Bank about the way it should provide more advisory expertise, for example. There are some questions about how we bring private creditors to the table to restructure private debts. When you've got debt interest levels that are so high at the moment, the fiscal space that many countries have got is dramatically squeezed at the moment. Are there any other complementary measures alongside that basic issue of increasing the amount of lending capability that the fund and the bank have? What else would you put alongside the package of support that's needed?
What comes to mind in terms of access to finance and lowering the impediment to investment is loan guarantee funds.
Yeah.
I believe that loan guarantee funds need little capital to start up, but its impact on low social income, you can target it at women, at special interest groups, at farmers. The actual fund could 10 times within 3 or 5 years. And that sort of investment, to me, hits all the right key points in terms of access to finance and guaranteeing those who can't otherwise borrow money without the existence of that kind of support and guarantee.
And is there a role for the private sector in the talks that you've seen? Have you seen private sector interest in coming in to help provide solutions if the complementary finance is available?
Yes and no, because at the end of the day, I think your financial institutions and your regulatory authorities need to be mature enough to handle something such as capital markets and private finance. And for Tonga, which is a very small economy, we would need somewhat of a support on a capacity side from IMF and World Bank enable us to receive that kind of attention.
And is that support available in the right level today, or does it need to step up?
Obviously, we're going to need to step it up. And I think the aspirations are there, but we need to get more solid support on the ground so that we can achieve it.
Yeah.
Talking with National Reserve Bank or Central Bank Governor, they have these papers in front of their board right now. But take, for instance, digital currency and all that new technology. They lack the capacity to vet some of the proposals that are on their table. They just don't know where up from down is.
Yeah, exactly. So final question, I suppose, really, is the mobilization of political pressure. What can you say about the way in which Tonga is working with other coalitions in settings like COP or at spring meetings or UN General Assembly? How do you think countries like yours, which are so egregiously affected by this crisis, how will you come together to step up the political pressure?
With due credit to the Pacific Island nations, I think that they've done a good job at sending the same message and being unified in their voice. The risk there on the international forum is that we might sound like cry wolf. And, you know, there's so much demand on people's attention, and we can say the same thing so many times before it becomes old. And that's the real risk right now, is that we need support from others apart from ourselves. We can lead you to the solution, but we need others to come with us too.
Yeah. I represent what's almost the youngest constituency in the UK, and I've just been so struck by the leadership, the political leadership of our younger generation here. Last year, I ran an Earthshot competition in a number of our schools, Earthshot prizes, you probably know, launched by Prince William and a group of others globally for a million pound prize. It's $1 million, £1 million. For good ideas to help with climate change.
And we heard from during the service,
yeah,
the commoners, exactly. the winner, something about packaging,
exactly.
Sustainable packaging.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very admirable.
So I tried to run a Earthshot Prize in 15 primary schools, mm-hmm. in my constituency. So you're talking about kids who are maybe between the ages of sort of 7 and 11. The two things that were so striking is one, the passion that younger generations here have to get a grip of this challenge. But second, the global awareness was just incredible. I mean, when you've got a 9-year-old child in inner city Birmingham being able to eloquently describe the impact of climate change on countries around the world, that I think is probably what gives me hope. And sometimes I think we've got to try and create stronger platforms for the next generation to actually unite globally.
Yeah.
That could be one of the political movements that could provide solutions to this.
I think the challenge now for constituents like yourself is to ensure that the youth are participating, yeah. making their voice heard at the ballot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, thank you for helping provide such a clear line of argument, a clear analysis of how this crisis is affecting Tonga, and some hope for how we mobilise to solve some of these problems, working together stronger for the future.
Thank you. It's an honour to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us.